Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.
Diverse, independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
India, in conjunction with Israel and the US, have been creating an ecosystem in which these countries invest in each other to such an extent that they become, if not sort of indistinguishable from each other, they are impossible to dislodge as oppressive systems. India is therefore invested in the occupation of Palestinians, Israel has become invested in the occupation of Kashmiris and the subjugation of Indian Muslims, and likewise.
That's Azad Issa, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Azad Issa on the India-Israel Alliance. Today, India and Israel have forged an alliance. It wasn't always that way. India became independent in 1947. Its first Prime Minister, Nehru, positioned his country as a champion of the Palestinian cause. As leader of the Non-Aligned Movement, India's stance on Palestine had great influence among other post-colonial nations. In the 1990s, that shifted. India moved into the U.S. orbit and embraced neoliberalism. And, at the same time, it moved closer to Israel. It was said if India wanted to be close to the United States, it had to reshape its critical policy towards Israel. And that they did. Today, the two countries have something in common. India's military occupation and domination of Kashmiris, and Israel's military occupation and domination of Palestinians. And India, under the Modi Hindutva Hindu nationalist regime, is the world's largest buyer of Israeli weapons. Israel, in return, buys weapons from India. Journalist and author Azad Issa says, Hindu nationalists have been observing how Israel has been behaving. More importantly, they're watching how the world is responding to it. They're noticing if you have America behind you, no one really can touch you. Our guest today is Azad Issa. He's an award-winning journalist and a senior reporter for Middle East Eye. His articles have appeared in The Guardian, Al Jazeera, and Foreign Policy. He's the author of Hostile Homelands, The New Alliance Between India and Israel. He gave the Harish Sharma Lecture at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia, in May 2025. And now, Azad Issa.
We are definitely in perilous times. 100 wars of different types and in scale and of relevance to the international media continue to manifest around the world. Sudan, Palestine, Kashmir, Congo, Yemen, Chhattisgarh, all connected by imperialism and theft of resources, climate destruction and corporate greed, all cruel legacies of colonialism. In the case of India, the systematic degradation of basic institutions from civil society to the media and the judiciary has left an already embattled Indian democracy into little more than a skeletal outline of a dream. You would know, for instance, that Amnesty International was forced out of India in 2020 after facing harassment and intimidation from Modi's government. Likewise, you would be well aware too that several Indians with OCI cards have been refused entry into India owing to the critique of Modi. Perhaps some of you would also know that several Kashmiris over the past five years have been placed on travel bans, pulled off planes as they're about to depart Delhi, detained, and asked to sign bonds agreeing that they would cease to write negatively about India in order to be released. This is the Modi government, we are told. But how many of us would know that as far back as the 1970s, the Indian government was revoking and stripping Indian citizens of their passports? So I hope you will indulge me as I narrate these details, but I feel that it would be negligent to speak of the present, today, and the future without acknowledging the continuities with the past. And history is so omnipresent during these times. Palestinians commemorated Nakba Day, the catastrophe of death and ethnic cleansing that came with the creation of Israel in 1948. Black activists and anti-colonial scholars will mark the centenary of Malcolm X, who was born on May 19, 1925. His internationalism and deep meditation on questions of liberation, justice, and solidarity is a radiant reminder of our interconnectedness. The issues that concerned him too, like Palestine, Sudan, the Congo, continue to burn with injustice. His refusal to back down and his ability to see through respectability politics, or what Muhammad al-Kurd would call the politics of appeal, as a means to appease liberal so-called dialogue, is foundational to recognizing and shoving the boot of our necks. And in the spirit of bluntness, it seems paramount to be blunt about our barely recognizable planet, you know, if we are ever to ever resurface. For this, we must talk about the Israeli genocide in Gaza as part of the larger economy of oppression and authoritarianism that does not merely carry the stamp of the West. In fact, the genocide in Gaza lies at the intersection of the building of a new world order in which the powerful are able to pursue expansion, domination, and the exertion of hard power over peoples, domestic or otherwise, with impunity. And the beating heart of this new pursuit is the burgeoning India and Israeli ties. This is not bluster, not hyperbole, but for this to make sense, we need to take a step back. When members of the Hari Sharma Foundation asked me to speak today about the relationship between India and Israel, the genocide in Gaza was in full flow, and the confrontation between India and Pakistan that threatened to escalate into war hadn't erupted. At the time, there was an uneasy calm between the two countries. Beneath the so-called calm, however, existed a story of Indian expansion in Kashmir, of the Indian state accumulating and implementing Israeli models in the most militarized region of the world, of the Indian state bringing tourists to Kashmir to depict a sense of normalcy. So the events in Kashmir, the events in Pehelgam, in Indian-occupied Kashmir, on April 22nd, where armed men shot dead tourists, purportedly on the basis of the religion, tased the status quo out of the stupor of what it really was about, a delusion. As per usual, confusion reigned as an armed group claimed responsibility, then denied it, citing that their online presence had been compromised. And the Indian state and its stenographers, known as the Indian media, willingly distilled the ambiguity to gift India its pretext to wage war within minutes. But not just to wage war against it, against who it deemed to be guilty in this context, Pakistan, but to use the opportunity to reinforce several myths to consolidate and unify the nation. First, that this was an attack that resembled October 7th, the Hamas-led attacks on Israel in 2023. Second, that this was an unwarranted, brutal, and heinous attack on innocent tourists by a savage ideology. Third, that this incident deserved a fitting reply that suited India's newfound brawn in a new chaotic world order. For this, too, the destruction of Gaza was invoked. Television channels spoke of carrying out a disproportionate response. They called for the army to bypass red lines to do so. The news media, along with Indian leaders, leaned into the Orientalist and war on terror lexicon of barbaric, dastardly, and savage to describe the incident in Pehelgam. There were news anchors like Arnab Goswami who called for, quote, a final solution for Pakistan. Hashtags we want revenge, hashtags destroy Pakistan popped up like digital billboards on the screen. Indian film stars too, who reside in parallel universes, marked their presence at Hindutva's digital headquarters by posting a jingoistic post or two. Obedience is a core principle in Modi's India, after all. Now, for a world horrified by genocide, live-streamed in Gaza, and largely familiar with Israeli propaganda over the past 18 months, the genocidal language from Indian channels was not difficult to discern. Even in a country where it's close to impossible to generalize one community, one idea, one narrative, There were very few who expressed public opposition to India's resort to unleash a punishment on Pakistan without it exhausting diplomatic efforts first, or without demonstrating proof to the world that Islamabad had actually orchestrated the incident in Pahalgam. It relied on an energy that the young would call trust me bro variety, and for collective antipathy of the West towards a Muslim majority country. These calls for revenge came from across the spectrum, from the far right to the Communist Party of the Marxist variety. In the context of multiple conflicts around the world, deepening economic instability in India itself, where Modi's great economic wins haven't translated into job growth, the boisterous drumbeats for war was not just vindictive, it was hysterical and dystopian. Whereas it was difficult just a decade ago to convince editors of international news media to cover ties between India and Israel, the symmetry today is so obvious it's being discussed and debated and torn apart in memes and TikTok videos. Hindu nationalists in India, many of whom endorsed Israel's action in Gaza as a legitimate war of defense, made no bones of calling for a so-called Gaza solution in Pakistan and Kashmir. This level of dehumanization of Palestinians in Gaza by Indians exerting their own fantasy of replicating the starvation of a people as they are bombed, left under rubble to suffocate, men, women, children alike, is a level of cruelty that can only be explained by mass delusion. It follows, too, the shameless support by Zionists for Israel's actions in Gaza. Gaza's destruction has been used as a cudgel, a flex by association with Israeli oppressors, is surely the mark of a sociopathic society in which cruelty has been normalized, empathy has been emptied out, and social values evaporated. And it's not only Hindu nationalists. At the other end of the spectrum, many liberals of the left persuasion, taken hostage by public pressure or driven by a deep set of jingoism that only Pakistan is able to trigger, trumped up support for the Jawans against what they seem to think was a legitimate war of attrition against the rogue neighbor. Terrorism for Pakistan had to be stopped, they argued. These attacks on Pakistan were getting out of hand, they chanted. Their nationalism was deemed so important, they were willing to suspend disbelief in the very state that had become the disinformation factory of the world because it involved Pakistan. They too didn't prioritize the need for proof or due process as per international conventions before endorsing striking its nuclear-armed neighbor. Both took their attacks on the Indian tourists in Pahalgam as an attack on the idea of India. Muddled with reports, the tourists were asked of their religious persuasion was enough to label it an attack on Hinduism itself. Now, even those Indians who would have not condemned the Hamas-led attacks on Israel on October 7th felt the need to immediately condemn the killing of tourists and call for swift revenge. They did so just as Israelis and many otherwise sensible Jewish Americans or Jewish American opponents of the Israeli occupation did after October 7th. And like their liberal and Zionist compatriots, few in India dared to ask obvious questions. The most glaring one being, are there a shortage of picnic spots in India? How is it normal for tourists to be picnicking in the world's most militarized zone known as Kashmir, where local Kashmiris live under de facto military law? Am I blaming the tourists? No. I am blaming India's occupation, which is at the root of all violence in Kashmir. Let me put it another way. Condemning the killing of tourists after they were picnicking in the world's most militarized zone and an occupied territory is to concede that their safety is more important than the people who actually live there. What is this except imperialism? But just as we've seen it done repeatedly, the chorus of condemnation took over and unified a country over the bellowing cry for vengeance. The Indian state saw it as a pretext to live out its Hindu nationalist fantasies. It leaned into the Hindutva's founding myths of being besieged and under threat from outsiders, of using the moment to reinforce a call to make India Hindu again, as they claim it was 1,000 years ago or thousands of years ago. To do this required bluster, to project oneself as masculine and militaristic, to project a new Hindu. Naturally, this involved unleashing terror against Muslims across the country. They had to be reminded, after all, that they were not part of the nation, that they had to be subservient to survive. And so what happened? The country unified behind the goal of providing punitive action. At the state level, the state canceled the Indus Water Treaty with Pakistan, threatening to cut the source of life to Pakistani farmers. On the local level, there were calls to boycott Muslims or Kashmiris. As one young Kashmiri girl doing her internship in Delhi told me, quote, "The auntie who used to sell me food daily stopped doing so. She denied me roti," end quote. The Indian state too found it an appropriate time as ever to remind its neighbors they survived on borrowed time. It called the military escalation against Pakistan Operation Sindoor. The name cuts deep into the ideological makeup of the Indian state, where a Hindu nationalist agenda, which has for decades projected itself as militaristic and masculine and modeled on European fascist movements, seeks to mark Pakistan and Pakistan-administered Kashmir as its territory. This was an allusion to the RSS manifesto of reunifying all of so-called ancient India once more. It's not an assessment that has gone down well with India's liberals and the left, who say that this is not the policy of the Indian state. But India is already a country of vigilante-led lynchings, of aunties denying lunches, and the military operating loitering drones over madrasas in Pakistan. Are those the policies of the state? Why then is it so hard to believe that expansion is next in line, if both the right wing and secular nationalists believe that India is broader than its existing borders? And what is this India-Israel relationship that makes all of this even remotely possible or plausible? For this, we must consider the bedrock of the relationship, the unironic impulse to buy weapons to save democracy. India purchases more weapons from Israel than any other country and has done so for more than a decade. These arms are used by Israel and Palestinians. Then they find their way to Kashmir, to India itself, like Chhattisgarh. They also constitute a methodology of conducting operations within India. Let me provide one example. In February 2024, Indian farmer protests erupted in the state of Haryana, in which people who feed the people of India demanded guaranteed minimum prices for their yield. They were showered with lead-based pellets and as well as tear gas from loitering drones. It was thereupon discovered that the tactics used on the farmers were directly informed by the state government's visit to Israel in 2018 during the Great March of Return protests in Gaza. Back then, Palestinians were calling for their right to return to their homes outside the concentration camp called Gaza. Several delegates with the state's security apparatus, including the chief minister, said that they were looking to, quote, replicate Israel's tactics in Haryana. Now, here's his full quote. "The idea behind the visit of the police delegation is to learn from Israeli experts how to improve the efficacy and efficiency of the law and order machinery to check crime and beef up security and intelligence network of the Haryana police," end quote. In other words, as Palestinians were being maimed by snipers, Indian leaders were studying how such ideas may be transplanted into Haryana. In this case, it took 6 years to activate. This is just one example. Like that, there are others in which the Indian states, like Maharashtra, have looked to implement methods of US and Israeli homeland security among the police departments. So what about the political or diplomatic level? How do we see those ties playing out? In late 2019, following the revocation of Article 370, the Indian Consul General in New York called for India to build Israeli-like settlements in Kashmir for Hindus to essentially conduct demographic change. Quote from the Consul General, "We already have a model in the world. If the Israeli people can do it, so can we," end quote. Then there's the Citizenship Amendment Act in conjunction with the National Register, the NRC, that turns Muslims into second-class citizens and makes religion a basis of citizenship. This mirrors Israel's law of return that grants all Jews the right to immigrate to Israel and receive immediate citizenship. Then there's the extraordinary story of Delhi's support for Israel during this genocide, as countries have tried to force a ceasefire and an arms embargo onto Israel. New Delhi has supplied weapons, including combat drones and components for bombs. The weapons Israel once upon a time sold to India were now being co-produced in factories across India itself to support Israel. These include AI weapons. Then there's a remarkable request by Indian companies to India to have workers sent over to Israel to replace Palestinian workers post October 7th. Today, 12,000 Indian caregivers and construction workers have been sent to replace Palestinian laborers, now barred from working in Israel. Several Indian unions called on workers not to go to Israel, but Modi's jobless economic growth means that workers, abandoned by a system that favors predators, presents few options for those working for upward mobility. Perhaps the most telling sign of all of this is India's refusal to endorse the case of genocide at the International Court of Justice. But even as a fight continues on the international level, another fight is taking place on the cultural and educational domains. For instance, you may have heard of or even watched Fauda, the wildly popular TV series revolving around a team of trigger-happy commandos who love to kill Palestinians in the West Bank. In classic fashion, the show doesn't explain why Israelis feel so insecure, nor does it illuminate why the Palestinians might resort to violence, aside from explanations that revolve around personal vengeance and mummy and daddy issues. The Israeli commandos are shown to break the law, all in the name of saving the nation, so much so that the audience is primed to support the crimes they must commit to save Israeli society. It is the TV series that effectively manufactures consent for war crimes. The show was so successful in India that filmmakers teamed up to produce Tanav, billed as an Indian remake of Fauda, set in Indian-occupied Kashmir. This is the level of consent for Israel being hardwired into Indian society. Take the rapid moves taking place among Indian universities over the past 18 months. As the biggest student movement since the anti-Vietnam War movement has engulfed universities across the US and parts of other parts of North America, as well as Europe, over the growing anxiety over the future of collaboration with American universities, Indian universities have gone the other way. To assuage Israeli concerns about changes within their US academy towards Israel, they have approached Indian universities for partnerships. So just as Palestinian workers' losses have been Indian workers' gain, the efforts of students to popularize the call for boycott and divestment at American universities has resulted in Indian universities' gain. During the course of this genocide, Indian universities have engaged or signed a mountain of deals with Israeli universities and weapons manufacturers. These partnerships, especially in the sciences, appear to focus not merely on building new hubs of defense and technology research for both the Indian and Israeli armed forces, but also as a means of exerting influence over Indian academia. But of course, these research ties aren't all about the military. They extend to more so-called innocuous fields, like agriculture and water tech, which the Israelis use as a means to extend control and pacify through resource extraction and exploitation. Israel's USAID equivalent, I mean, the USAID doesn't exist anymore, but the equivalent, Mashav, is providing fellowships and short-term courses in Israel for Indians. Today, Indians make up the highest share of foreign students in Israel. So the attacks on Pakistan then have to be seen through the prism of an ethno-nationalist state that wants to paralyze dissent, subsume difference and diversity into a single stream of political ideological consciousness called Hindu nationalism. And to accomplish this project of mass pacification, India has turned to Israel for its expertise and for inspiration. And part of this effort has been the instrumentalization of the word democracy to achieve autocratic ends. Given that the occupation of Kashmir didn't start with Modi, that the pogroms against Muslims and Sikhs didn't occur exclusively under the BJP-led governments, and that India was a Hindu-majoritarian country from the get-go, how did India get away with projecting itself as the antithesis of belligerence and as anti-colonial? For this, we can talk about Indian soft power that characterized Indianness, of family values, respect for elders, secularism, as traditional, hardworking, and educated. We can talk about Hindi popular cinema, cricket, yoga, Ayurveda, even Kama Sutra. In this way, Indian soft power is not so different from American soft power. American soft power, too, has sought to project a country as a nation that believed in certain values. It has perpetuated ideas about its beliefs and values. It has even feigned a certain self-reflection and notion of free speech to project its democratic exceptionalism. Now, India, having exerted soft power around the world, has shown an ambition to exert its newly acquired hard power as it sees fit. It wants to be taken seriously as a power, to be leader of the G20, to be on the United Nations Security Council as a permanent member. But how did India move from being a seemingly non-belligerent, non-violent land of Gandhi and the Lotus position to one which calls for flattening of its neighbor? Who helped project India to these lofty heights? And what does it have to do with India and Israel ties? Or with India's complicity in this genocide? Again, we need to go back, perhaps now, to partition and of Palestine and the subcontinent. I cannot surely get into all the fabrications of partition, the disinformation, the myths about India, many of which have been spread by Indian scholars or through Indian popular or American cinema, but I can allude to how we got here from an incident in 1947. In June 1947, Albert Einstein at the IAS in Princeton wrote to Nehru, the leader of the Indian National Congress, asking him, as the leader of the incoming Indian government, to support the formation of a Jewish state. In his letter to Nehru, Einstein writes, "May I tell you of the deep emotion with which I have read that the Indian Constituent Assembly has abolished untouchability. I read that the curse of the pariah was about to be lifted from millions of Hindus in the very days when the attention of the world was fixed on the problem of another group of human beings who, like the untouchables, have been victims of persecution and discrimination for centuries." He continues, "I find profoundly gratifying the fact that the reconstruction of Palestine has taken not through the exploitation of native workers, the usual pattern of imperialism, but through the heroic toil of Jewish pioneers. The once malaria-ridden swamps, the stony mountain slopes, the salt shores of the Dead Sea, now fertile and blooming, are evidence of a creative impulse whose thwarting would make mankind, as well as Jew and Arab, the poorer," Einstein wrote. In his reply to Einstein, Nehru refuses to take a firm position. He declines the invitation to be a patron of the new Jewish state. He says that he's not competent to pass a final opinion as to what should be done. But his overall answer is quite illuminating. "I have paid a good deal of attention to this problem of Palestine. I have read books and pamphlets on the subject issued on either side. Yet I cannot say that I know all about it or that I am competent to pass a final opinion as to what should be done. I know the Jews have done a wonderful piece of work in Palestine and have raised the standards of the people there. But one question troubles me. After all these achievements, why have they failed to gain the goodwill of the Arabs? Why do they want to compel the Arabs to submit against their will? The way of approach has been one which does not lead to a settlement, but rather to the continuation of the conflict. I have no doubt that the fault is not confined to one party." He finishes. Now, what is particularly fascinating about this exchange, and there are many, is the level of myth-making on both sides. You have Einstein talking about the end of caste. As you know, that's false. It was false in 47, it's false today. Hindu nationalists today have themselves tried to co-opt caste into the project. Likewise, Einstein repeats myths that the Zionists built up the land, showing how ubiquitous this perception was in Zionist circles. This, too, is a myth that continues to circulate today. On the part of Nehru, as you may note, he says both sides have erred. And he goes on to recognize that Zionists have helped build up Palestine. Now, this is the great anti-colonialist, as many remember him, meekly saying that he does not know how the colonial project in Palestine may be resolved. It is this exchange that sets up the symbolic parameters of the relationship between India and Israel in the decades to come. Yes, Einstein changed his mind about Israel, of which much has been written. But did anyone correct him on the question of caste or of his impression of the moral compass of the Indian state coming into being? The exchange, too, showcases the level of myth-making at the heart of America's institutions. Einstein, sitting at Princeton, invokes India's purported success of eliminating caste as a means to draw India closer to the Zionist project. Likewise, Nehru, like many leftists and liberals in India, would appear to do later on, accepts this praise despite knowing